Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is James Loney, who's a Canadian peace activist, writer, and member of Christian Peacemaker Teams. Based in Toronto, he served on violence reduction teams in Iraq, Palestine, and the First Nation communities in Canada. In November 2005, he was kidnapped along with the rest of his delegation that he was leading and held hostage for 4 months. One member of the group was murdered, an American named Tom Fox. The surviving three were released in a military operation led by British and American Special Forces. His latest book, Captivity, examines the paradoxes we face when our most cherished principles are tested in extraordinary circumstances and explores the universal truths of humanity and forgiveness in the face of brutality and deprivation. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Loney.
Thank you, Ian.
And let me understand just initially what you were thinking of when you went to Iraq as a Christian. Now, you're not necessarily a Christian missionary, but you're there with the Christian Peacemaker team. And my understanding is that any overt Christianity in Muslim lands is an absolute anathema. In Afghanistan, it could result in your death. And I imagine in Iraq, it was not exactly welcome. So what kind of understanding did you have going into Iraq about being a Christian?
Well, I had been there on three different occasions. The first time was just before the invasion and occupation began in 2003. My experience was that being a Christian wasn't really a problem. I think we were very clear with people that we were not there to convert anybody or proselytize. We were there to do human rights work as motivated by our faith. And the people that I met and that the team worked with didn't see that as a problem. I think they understood and respected our faith, and I think in some way understood our motivation. Also in Iraq, there was a sizable community of Christians who had been there for, I don't know, I think going back to the time of Jesus. And as kind of the sectarian violence kind of unfolded, especially in the 2005 and onward, Christians began to feel very threatened and leave the country. But that was really kind of, I think, a result of the unleashing, really, of hate in a society that occupation and war, that kind of effect it has.
So in November 2005, James Loney, when you were snatched by this group calling themselves the Swords of Righteousness Brigade, that was at the height of the so-called insurgency that President Bush and Vice President Cheney were kind of trying to deny at the time. So you were there at a very, very tense moment, surely.
Yes, I guess it, as it turned out to be in retrospect, yes. Mm-hmm.
So tell me about the circumstances in which you were kidnapped, because you were attending a meeting at a mosque with a human rights officer at the Muslim Scholars Association, and you had some security with you. And what was your relationship then with the Muslim Scholars Association? They, again, were comfortable with you being a Christian, or were you were there as a human rights worker? Tell me how the introductions were made and what the meeting was about.
So I believe that was our second meeting. The team had, it was my first time going there, but the team had been to meet them, I think, at least one time before. We knew that the Muslim Scholars Association, as I understand it, were trying to position themselves to be sort of the official kind of religious body representing the Sunni community in Iraq. And we had an idea that they may have had links to the insurgency. And so that was part of the reason I think we wanted to establish a relationship with them. As part of our strategy, we wanted to connect with as many different political perspectives and actors as possible within Iraq.
And does that mean that you were actually using the Muslim Scholars Association to try and reach the insurgents themselves in order to have a dialogue? Is that what you had in mind?
Well, not exactly to have a dialogue with the insurgents, but just in our work with Iraqis, with understanding the situation, to build allies, to establish connections with as broad a spectrum as possible. in part also for documenting human rights abuses. We were interested, for example, in getting access to people who had been in prison or who were being targeted. And so sometimes by connecting with a particular group, we could have access to people who were being affected by the occupation. Our main focus was on the occupation itself and identifying that as the root problem, rather than trying to influence the Iraqi response to the occupation. We were working on the occupation itself.
Obviously, there was some kind of a collusion there with the Muslim Scholars Association, as much as you were quickly snatched on the street when you left the meeting. So somebody tipped somebody off, and then you were taken to this safe house and you hooded and shackled, and you just never knew how long it was going to be, right? Once you were a prisoner.
Yeah. To this day, I have no idea. It seems like it was a setup. And the group that kidnapped us, they identified themselves to us as Saif al-Haq, our Righteous Sword Brigade. And what they told us was that they had a political arm, and it seemed that there was some kind of hierarchy that they were part of. The people that were making decisions about us, our fate, were invisible to us, but they were somewhere up above in a chain. And they seemed to be Sunni, I think, is my understanding of their identity.
But they were violently anti-American, right? And then, and I guess it must have been from day one, the American with you, Tom Fox, he must have been terrified, and of course he was murdered, right?
Yes. There were two of us were Canadian, national, and then another person, Norm, was British, and Tom was American. And Tom and Norman were both kind of treated in this different category because their countries were the primary agents of the occupation and invasion. And so when videos were taken, for example, they were put in orange jumpsuits, which were what Guantanamo prisoners were made to wear, and we were not. So that those are examples of kind of how we were treated differently. And there was a lot of antipathy towards Tom because of what the military had done, U.S. military done in the United States, in Iraq. And the captors had stories to tell us about how the guards, how they themselves had been impacted by that. One of the guards had his home bombed, and he said his parents and sister and fiancé were all killed. Another had his home destroyed and was living as a refugee in Baghdad. Another talked about how his sister's family, his nieces and nephew, were killed at a checkpoint. So they had these stories that they told us to, I guess, explain why they were doing what they were doing.
And one of your captors was a sniper who specialized in killing American soldiers.
So he said, yes.
Mm. So tell me what happened when they killed Tom Fox. What were the circumstances?
Well, we don't actually know. Tom was separated from us on February the 12th, 2006, and the captors had set up this story that we were going to be released. We were going to be taken one by one in the trunk of a car to the first house where we were held, and then taken back to the mosque where we were kidnapped from. And we were very excited because this was the first kind of specific detail about how we were, because they kept promising we will be released, and so this was the first time there's actually any detail. So they took Tom first, but then never came back, never took the rest of us. So we began to suspect that he had been separated from us, but didn't really know what the implication of that was. And then a couple of things happened that gave us a hint that the worst thing that we had been fearing, that he had been murdered, had happened. That happened on March the 9th, which was exactly 2 weeks before we were released. And it was only when we were released, was the first thing I asked the soldiers, you know, what happened to Tom. And they told us that he was killed, and I asked, you know, did they find his body? Yes. And so then that was when we knew.
Again, I'm speaking with James Loney. He's a Canadian peace activist. writer and member of the Christian Peacemaker teams. He was in Iraq in November 2005. He was kidnapped along with the rest of his delegation and was held for 118 days before being released by a joint British SAS and American Special Forces team. He's written about his experience in his book, Captivity, 118 Days in Iraq and the Struggle for a World Without War. So not only are you a Christian and you're a pacifist in a country that's a Muslim country at war with a Christian army, and that was always, of course, something that bin Laden was trying to make hay out of, the idea that the Crusaders were coming into Muslim lands. On top of that, you yourself are gay, and that the revelation would have killed you, right? Was that was a pervasive fear that you had amongst, in terms of your captors?
It was something that, I felt would not have been helpful for me, especially, and probably for the group, if they knew that about me. And so I was kind of hoping that they wouldn't find that out. Yeah.
The book really talks about that you found humanity and forgiveness in the face of this brutality and deprivation. How did you bridge the hatred and hostility?
Yeah, that's a good question, because it was an intensely difficult experience, and I hated being held hostage, and it was a very intrusive thing to have to deal with, and I experienced a lot of anger at this ongoing situation. And I found that one of the things that helped me was, one of our strategies was that if we could make visible our humanity to the guards, the captors, that would make it harder for them to mistreat us and ultimately, I think, to kill us. And so we kind of adopted that strategy. And in order to, I think, to awaken someone's awareness of your humanity, I think you have to see their humanity first. And so it actually helped me, the more that I could see the humanity of these men, these guards, and the less I suffered, the less angry I was. And it was just helpful in the day-to-day dealing with that situation. And I began to see that their commitment to violence was causing them to suffer. And as the experience unfolded, I felt like I was seeing and learning things about the nature of violence that confirmed for me the truth of my own commitment to nonviolence.
How do you remain a pacifist when you had so much brutality meted out against you by these, obviously, you know, some kind of al-Qaeda, I hate to use the word al-Qaeda, but some, you know, Iraqi Sunni extremist groups, they call themselves the Swords of the Righteous Brigade, but the long the short it is, you not only did you see war up close in terms of the faces of the enemy, if you will, and they murdered your friend, you were rescued by a team of British SAS and US Special Forces who risked their lives to free you from this agony. Mm-hmm. So
yeah.
How did that affect your pacifism?
It was a challenge, certainly, and I had to rethink at times what my commitment was and whether it continued to make sense to me. And it's not, you know, there's different aspects to answering that question. But one way I would start to do that is, the captors would sometimes take us to watch movies with them. They get these American films, you know, the captor we called Junior, you know, he liked action film. And one film I remember watching was called Transporter 2, which is the story of an evil arch nemesis, Giuliani, who he's a drug lord, and he has this plan to kidnap the son of the chief drug enforcement officer in the United States and infect the son with bacterial warfare agents. And when he's released, ransomed out, he'll infect his father, who will then infect the president and the whole cabinet, and he'll take over the world. And as we're watching this film, I was astonished to see the captors cheering for the good guy, Frank Stratham, or whatever his name was, who is going after the bad guy, Gianni, who has kidnapped the helpless innocent. And I'm thinking, somebody's confused here. And, you know, I look down at my wrists and I can see the red marks from my the handcuffs I've been wearing all day. And yes, I'm the kidnapped person here. I'm the victim, and you have the gun and the keys. You're the kidnapper, which kind of makes you the bad guy, but you're cheering for the good guy who's going for the bad guy and going after the bad guy. And it struck me that our captors, they call themselves Mujahideen, holy warriors of God, they saw themselves as the good guys. And the soldiers, I heard an American soldiers use this exact phrase, we're here to get the bad guys, or that's a bad guy. The soldiers who were sent by the American administration saw themselves as good guys, going after bad guys. And it struck me that really then there is no difference between the soldiers and the insurgents, because they're living from the same basic narrative. The only difference is in the name that they've assigned to each other. And I think if we look at the dynamics of violence, there's always a pointing finger, there's always an accusation, there's a story, a narrative that explains why the use of violence is necessary and inevitable. And in fact, when we use violence, what happens to us is that we become the very thing that we are fighting against. We become the image of our enemy through the means, the weapons that we use.
James Lenny, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to share about my book.
Again, I've been speaking with James Loney. He's a Canadian peace activist, writer, and member of a Christian peacemaker team. He served in nonviolent reduction teams in Iraq, Palestine, and the First Nations community of Canada. In November of 2005, he was kidnapped with his delegation and was held hostage for 4 months. And one member of his group was murdered, an American named Tom Fox. The surviving three were released in a military operation led by British SAS and American Special Forces. And his latest book, Captivity, the 118 Days in Iraq and the Struggle for a World Without War, tells the story of how, in these extraordinary circumstances, he discovered humanity and forgiveness in the face of brutality and deprivation. So what do we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we began with John Mueller, who's kind of a contrarian but a very welcome voice, who explodes the myth of the war on terror and of our need for a constant enemy. We talked, of course, about the president in Afghanistan, talking about the 2014 exit strategy. He touched on the history of America's longest war and the first anniversary of the killing of al-Qaeda. And even though the evidence are that al-Qaeda is all but finished, terrorism alarmists in this country keep beating the drum that they can strike anywhere and keep it suggesting that everything that happens in the world is somehow related to al-Qaeda, whether it's in Yemen, in Somalia, in Nigeria now. The beat goes on. And then we talked with a Pakistani lawyer who was the co-founder of the Foundation for Fundamental Rights, an organization that represents victims of drone strikes in Pakistani courts. We wanted to get a different opinion. The other day, I got quite a lot of angry mail from a law professor who said the drones were very discriminating. He didn't, of course, this Pakistani lawyer who represents victims of collateral damage, thought otherwise and feels that Americans will wake up one day soon, even though 8 out of 10 Americans support the use of drones, when drones become used for surveillance over their own homes and communities, he felt that there'd be a kind of a change of tune here in the United States, that there ought to be some kind of international regime between countries, because they could end up causing war, because they would, you know, essentially going into each other's airspace, etc. Then finally, I spoke with this Canadian peace activist who was held by these jihadis in Iraq, a group called the Swords of the Righteous, for 118 days. all the while hiding the fact that he's gay. He was, his American companion was murdered. He was lived in terror, but eventually was freed by a joint SAS and U.S. Special Forces team. So I ask him, you know, as a pacifist, how do you feel about these guys risking their lives to save you? And also, how did you somehow find in your Christian soul how to deal with these murderous extremists? This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The other became a car.